Hello and welcome to Preprints in Motion.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers and discuss their latest preprint and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia. But we don't stop there. Every month we'll be bringing you special episodes with open science leaders where we discuss how to fix academia. Easy, right? So hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod. But for now, let's get into the show. This week we sit down with Emily Sherman and Brian Emmer to discuss their latest preprint, Identification of ACE2 Modifiers by CRISPR Screening. So thank you for joining us. I enjoyed this paper a lot. I have done some COVID work of my own, and so I try still to keep on top of the literature. But because we've got two lovely guests with us today, I thought it might be good if you introduced yourselves so people can recognize your voices. So Brian, maybe do you want to introduce yourself first?
Sure. My name is Brian Emmer. I'm an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Michigan. Clinically, I spend 20% of my overall effort as a hospitalist, a general internal medicine doctor for admitted inpatients at the University of Michigan Hospital. And then 80% of my effort is spent running my own lab, just recently launched here towards the later stages of the pandemic. And we use high throughput CRISPR technologies. We're interested in functional genomics, previously working on atherosclerosis, cardiovascular disease, and cholesterol regulation. And then, as we'll talk about during the pandemic, we pivoted to work on SARS-CoV-2 biology and ACE2 regulation.
And Emily?
So my name's Emily Sherman. I was a postdoc with Brian in his lab up until about, 2 months ago. I just started a position working for Takara Bio USA. But for this work, obviously, I was Brian's first postdoc, and I had worked with him also before in David Ginsberg's lab. So that's where I completed my PhD and where Brian completed his postdoc. And as Brian mentioned, we were previously using our CRISPR screening tools to study cholesterol regulation.
So you must have been really, really great for Brian to think he needs you when he starts his new lab, right?
I mean,
absolutely. I was extremely fortunate. We had been working very closely together during my postdoc and Emily's PhD, and I was very lucky that she was willing to come with me when I started my own lab.
So I'm going to ask loads of questions about what it's like to start your own lab in the midst of a pandemic. And I've also been the first postdoc in lab, so I've got questions about that. But we'll start with the sciencey stuff. So as you've kind of already touched upon, your lab does not necessarily do COVID work. That's not what you started the lab for. I don't think that's what anyone started a lab for. But you did shift your focus towards COVID. So could you get into a little bit about why you pivoted over and what prompted that switch?
Sure. Yeah, I think it was motivated by two things. I think one was sort of the sense of kind of all hands on deck and the state that we were in at the time that we started this. We wanted to try to make some kind of contribution. And the other part of it was the technical aspect of it. And the project that we were working on, although the scientific field was different, a lot of the tools that we applied were very similar. And we had just been doing the screen for modifiers of the LDL receptor, an important protein that's involved in cholesterol regulation and modulates cardiovascular disease risk. And for that screen, we had taken cells and mutagenized them and then isolated mutants with differences in LDL receptor levels by flow cytometry. And so when the pandemic started and we were thinking about different kind of projects that we might do, one idea that seemed conceptually very simple was to basically swap out an antibody instead of detecting LDL receptor to detect the receptor for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, ACE2. So it was kind of that combination of factors.
And this actually is a really nice paper. So my code work was kind of looking at the literature and we were looking at how people were pivoting their research, because certainly at the start of the pandemic, we had a lot of physicists coming over and pretending to be biologists. But this is a really good example where you've taken an established expertise and switched it over very appropriately and to what looks like to quite good effect. So how did you know what molecular pathways regulate ACE2? And, how do we prevent those detrimental effects when we're using drugs to treat the ACE2? Because the ACE2, of course, is not part of the virus. It's on our own cells.
Right. And I think that was also part of our motivation to kind of launch this project was that, of course, ACE2, it was not conserved throughout evolution to be a receptor for viruses. It has a physiologic function and it's been implicated in other disease states. So it was its own topic of research for a long time before this. And so even if COVID went away quickly, obviously that didn't happen. I think there were still a lot of valid reasons to be interested in the regulation of ACE2 for its own sake. In terms of what pathways, how do we know which pathways to test? Originally, we didn't know. I mean, there was certainly some literature out there to suggest that some pathways might be involved, but we really like the idea of kind of an unbiased, high throughput, ideally genome-wide CRISPR screen. Using flow cytometry as our selection mechanism, it's hard to achieve the kind of depth that we need for a well-powered genome-wide screen. And so what ended up working much better for us was a more focused kind of targeted screen. And we drew from many different data sets for the genes that we nominated as putative ACE2 regulators. Those include screens done by others for SARS-CoV-2 cytopathic effect, some other work that we had done looking at transcripts by RNA-seq that were correlated with ACE2 expression. And then pulling from human genetics too, and looking at some of the loci in the human genome where genetic variation is associated with susceptibility to COVID-19. So we ended up kind of having a targeted library that was informed in part also by our own pilot genome-wide screens that were a little underpowered. So we can't claim kind of comprehensive genome-wide coverage. So the ones that weren't tested by our focus library, we can't say whether or not they have an impact or not on ACE2. But for the ones that were included in our focus library, I think we have a high degree of confidence in the functional effects, at least in this context of this cell line.
And as Brian mentioned, like we kind of, you know, we were really figuring this out as we went in the very beginning. You know, Brian's brain is definitely geared towards CRISPR screens. And I don't know, I'm sure he can think of a CRISPR screen for just about any question you might want to answer. So, I mean, you know, initially we had lots of different ideas for how we could leverage CRISPR screening. You know, for this sort of COVID-related research and ACE2, you know, we kind of just learned as we went. And it turned out that we were just really the best or most well-poised to take on the ACE2 regulation pathway.
I think John's a big fan of screens. With a screen, though, you always need to follow out with sort of validation of your hits. So maybe it would be good to talk about how you've validated some of those things you've found.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think validation is critical. I think, you know, ultimately what we did was single gene knockout. So we took the top 20 or so genes from our screen, and then we cloned individual lenti-CRISPR targeting constructs, and we made different cell lines in an arrayed format. We tested the impact of those modifiers in ACE2 abundance. And there was a high rate of validation, but I think our confidence in that was very high going into it because when we did the screen, we did it in two different ways. We started, you know, earlier we had made this observation in the cell line that we were using and in multiple cell lines that this was not like like LDL receptor, where we saw that every cell had LDL receptor expression and there was variation in the levels. This was much more of a binary phenomenon where we saw that even in these cells that are supposedly genetically identical and are growing in the same dish, there's only a subset of cells. There's a high degree of heterogeneity. And so in EQH7 cells that we tested, at any given time, only 3 to 5% of those cells expressed ACE2. And the remaining 95 to 97% had no flow cytometry staining above kind of autofluorescence. And we were very careful to be rigorous in our antibody staining to make sure we had a specific antibody. And we made ACE2 knockout cell lines and tested actually 13 different antibodies. It felt like a doomed project at many times.
Yeah.
But we ultimately found one that worked well. And so there was this heterogeneity, but that also limited our power for our screen, that if we only had 3 to 5% of the cells that were positive, we would have to flow sort many more cells to find functional modifiers. And so to try to overcome that, we did serial enrichment by flow cytometry for ACE2 staining. And so we took ACE2 positive cells from that heterogeneous population and we expanded them. And then we sorted them again, and we could enrich from 3 to 5% in that starting population up to about 70 or 80% ACE2 positivity. And so we did the screen both ways, either on the kind of parental cells with 3 to 5% positivity or on the serially enriched cells with 70 to 80% positivity. And we sort of thought the former would be more powered to pick up repressors or like transcriptional silencers of ACE2, and the latter would be more likely to pick up enhancers, you know, positive or negative regulators. That actually ended up not really being the case. We saw a very high degree of concordance between those two independent screens. I'm not sure how much value it really added, you know, in hindsight to do it two different ways. But I think because we had that concordance, it gave us a lot of confidence that what we were seeing was real. This was not stochastic variation. You know, I think you could even argue that the second screen was sort of like a validation screen of the original screen. But at any rate, we did the, you know, to make a long story short, we did the single gene knockouts to do the validation of the functional effect.
So that heterogeneity is quite interesting. Do you know what was driving that in your cells?
We did a little bit of work on that, not to like just plug ourselves, but we had another paper prior to this one that was more on, you know, these pathways that are governing ACE2 expression. So kind of as Brian hinted at, it took us a lot longer than we expected to even find an antibody that was specific, truly specific to ACE2. And, you know, initially we thought this project would just take us a couple months. We'd do the screen really quickly. We had the system already in place, and that was just not the case. It was a year plus long endeavor, as always is the case in science. But
yeah, those couple month projects are the best, right?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, we and in doing these studies and finding the specific ACE2 antibody, we realized this sort of phenomenon that Brian described of the heterogeneity. And so we ended up doing some extra work on that to try and figure that out. We did some RNA-seq to look for differentially expressed genes and pathways in ACE2 positive and ACE2 negative cells. And, you know, we found some suspects, but not really any sort of smoking gun as to this is clearly the pathway that regulates ACE2. So that also, you know, added some difficulty, but.
Yeah, and Emily did some really great work kind of characterizing that heterogeneity. So, you know, at first we looked at whether it was mediated at the protein level or at the RNA level. You know, could it be that the negative cells had ACE2, but it was just inside the cell? That was not the case. You know, so we did some microscopy and we did permeabilization of cells and flow cytometry. And it really was that the cells that were negative didn't have any ACE2 protein, and they didn't have as much mRNA when we did qPCR. We know that that's heritable. So if we take the ACE2 positive cells or the ACE2 negative cells, and we look at kind of the maintenance of that expression over generations as the cells divide, we see that it is heritable, but it's not fixed. So eventually, if we take those enriched cells over time, they revert back towards that 3-5% positivity for H287 cells. So we think that supports the idea of kind of epigenetic regulation of ACE2 expression in these cells. And so we, like Emily mentioned, we did the RNA-seq comparing the transcriptomes of the expressing and non-expressing cells and got some clues. But ultimately, the CRISPR screen is what we wanted to do to find kind of functional modifiers of ACE2 expression.
No, I'm glad you mentioned the other paper. We're here to plug you. We're plugging you as much as we can. So my whole scientific career so far seems to be based around heterogeneity and proving heterogeneity exists. And it's so much harder than I think, well, harder than I thought. I went, my PhD was all about macrophage heterogeneity in Drosophila. And I went in fact, very naively went in thinking that it was really easy. It's a simple question, right? It's not. It's a much, much harder question than I thought.
We're learning that lesson too.
Yeah. And there's heterogeneity everywhere. It just never seems to end. So you're targeting the ACE2, obviously with that being on our cells. Is this something that is a potential to the vaccines that we've had developed? Is this something we could run alongside those? Because presumably this would be a lot more resistant to any mutations that the virus might pick up, for example.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, one of the concerns, so obviously blocking the interaction between the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2 and ACE2 is very effective. And, you know, these vaccines are highly efficacious. I think, you know, obviously another concern is that as the virus has this kind of potential for rapid evolution, and we see these variants emerging, one concern would be if the virus picks up mutations in the spike protein that allow it to escape the immunity that's elicited either by natural infection or by vaccines. You know, that would be sort of a doomsday scenario and really painful if we all had to go through kind of pandemic 2.0. And I think it's attractive to think that if we could modulate host ACE2, you know, perhaps we could achieve the same effect. If, rather than, you know, targeting that interaction, not at the viral spike protein, but at the host ACE2 itself, viruses evolve on the order of, you know, minutes or hours. Humans evolve on a much longer time frame. And so it would be more resistant to kind of evolve, you know, viral resistance. I think that would be a hope. But of course, there are a lot of other considerations that would go along with that and, you know, whether it would be safe to downregulate ACE2 in people or not.
I mean, when I was reading it, it kind of reminded me of the more recent approaches in the immunocancer oncology field. So now a lot of the current treatments for cancer are coming out as us actually modulating the immune system. So that's the CAR T cell therapy and stuff, which seems to be actually quite strong, right? If you look at that data, it seems like that's actually a better method of tackling cancer than traditional treatments.
Yeah, it's a super exciting area for sure. I think the other part with these two is there's this kind of, you know, interesting duality of kind of ACE2's contribution to infection. And I think it's very clear early on that ACE2 is important for establishing infection and serving as the receptor for the virus. But there's some really nice work with SARS-CoV-1, kind of the original SARS, that during infection, there's a Nature Medicine paper in 2005, I'm blanking on the authors, but there's a very nice paper that shows during infection that ACE2 protein levels go down. And ACE2 does have this physiologic function in the renin angiotensin system that has these physiologic effects on cardiovascular and pulmonary biology. And so it's been shown that ACE2 deficiency contributes to the pathology of acute lung injury in many different models. And so it could be that early on SARS-CoV-2 establishes infection through ACE2. It has this kind of proviral, but later on the downregulation of ACE2 contributes to some of the acute lung pathology that we see. And so arguably restoring ACE2 levels later on during infection may have a protective effect. But I think our ability to develop therapeutics that do that is limited by our lack of understanding of what controls ACE2 expression.
That feeds brilliantly into my next question. So what was your end goal, right? So when you were publishing this work, was it to find modulators that you could sort of target, or was it to understand that pathway in more detail, or potentially both?
I think potentially both. I think at the very beginning when we did this, maybe we were a little bit naive. Emily mentioned how we had different ideas of different screens that we'd like to try. The simplest one seemed to be to look at cytopathic effect. And so to take a cell line that was susceptible to SARS-CoV-2, to mutagenize it and then infect it. And we sort of anticipated that all the cells would die that were infected, and we might have rare mutants, you know, host factors that were important to the viral infection or to viral pathogenesis, that when we disrupted them, those cells would become resistant to viral toxicity. And the dream scenario that I sort of had early on was, well, what if we found pathways that we could then target with existing drugs, and those that were already in clinical use, and we could look at those for repurposing? I think that was our original goal, and we did some attempts. We had some great collaborators. We didn't know how to do the BSL-3 work, and we're not virologists. And so Christiane Wobis and Andrew Tai and Johnny Sexton here were really instrumental in doing all of the viral work that we did. But I think that was our original goal. And then it morphed over time.
As it does, right?
Yeah. And like Brian said, the slam dunk would have been to, you know, find a miracle target or something that we already have existing drugs for. But we did end up doing a couple of CPE screens. Carmen Mirabelli also helped in a lot of the virus work. So we have some results from that I'm not sure what we're going to do with yet. But a lot of other labs have come out with their own CPE screens too for SARS-CoV-2, which we actually ended up pulling some candidates from for our own. And we did a virus work also in following up on, you were asking about our follow-up early. We actually did a little bit of follow-up with some SARS-CoV-2 infectivity on some of our more interesting ACE2 candidates. So that was a cool experiment too.
No, I'm very quickly learning just how good collaborators actually are in science. Always good to get out there and work with as many people as you can. I think so anyway. So we've talked a lot about what you've done in that you've been doing a CRISPR screen, but we haven't quite covered what a CRISPR screen actually, what it is, how it works. I think most people listening are probably familiar with what CRISPR is, but maybe it would be good to have a little overview of how you set up a CRISPR screen and how you do this kind of work.
Sure. I can go ahead and talk about how we do our screen. So we have a whole genome library that came out of Feng Zhang's lab several years ago. So we use the Gecko V2 library for our whole genome screens, which contains about 124,000 guides, I think. So it targets nearly every gene in the human genome with 6 guide RNAs per gene. So, you know, a big part of CRISPR screening and, you know, getting it right is depth of coverage. So you want to make sure in your pool of cells, or I guess backing up to the guide level, we create a lentiviral library that contains all of those 124,000 guides, as well as Cas9. And so when we transduce a pool of cells, each cell in that dish, a contains a different guide RNA, and so is mutated to knock out a different gene in the genome. And so, you know, ideally you need to generate a pool of cells large enough that you have sort of equal representation, which for us, we shoot for 200 to 500X coverage, so that we'll have sort of an equal probability of knocking out, you know, sampling all these different genes in the genome. And so then once we have that large pool of mutants, we can screen them for some functional effect. So whether it be in our past work, we've done LDL cholesterol uptake. So measuring cells that are either deficient or have enhanced LDL uptake. And then, you know, more recently, looking at mutants that have either high ACE2 expression or low ACE2 expression. And then, you know, our output for this is usually flow cytometry or FACS sorted cells. And sort of at the end of the screen, we can collect, in our case, tails of a distribution is kind of how we like to think of it. So the top 5% or and bottom 5% or 7.5%, wherever we decide to choose our gates. And we can look at the genomic DNA of the cells that we isolate in either of those populations and use next-gen sequencing to determine what genes are knocked out or targeted in each of those cell populations, if that makes sense.
I now understand what Emma does now, because this sounds very similar to what Emma does, yeah, on a daily basis. So when Emma was reading this paper, one thing she brought up was the fact that you seem to use quite a lot of guide RNAs. And so does this allow you greater depth in your analysis than using fewer does?
I think so. I think there's a few considerations. I think one is that although we have multiple guide RNAs per gene, we know that not every guide RNA has activity. And so with our genome-wide library, when we have 6 guide RNAs per gene, we might see signals that are driven more by the fact that for some genes, maybe 1 or 2 guides are active, and for some, all 5 or all 6 are active. When we sample with a greater number of guide RNAs, up to 15, we kind of smooth out that difference, I think. And I think it's just a statistical power kind of thing that when we integrate the signal over 15 guides, we get, I think, a more robust detection or quantification of the effect. And so I think we can really see that in both our LDL screen, but also this screen. When we look at the 2 different screens that I mentioned, starting with either the parental cells or the ACE2 enriched cells, we see this very high degree of reproducibility between those 2 screens or concordance between those 2 screens. But it's not just with the genes that have the biggest effect when they're perturbed. It's not just the top genes. Even with kind of the modest effects, you know, those towards the median of the distribution, but still have some skew one way or another, we see that there's a high degree of correlation between those. And so I think that we are picking up on even subtle effects, which may not be biologically important, but I think that that's a reflection of the fact that we have really high depth of coverage in our library.
Is there an upper limit to that as to how many guide RNAs you can use? I imagine at some point you start to lose the benefit, right?
Yeah, we haven't formally tested that. I certainly think there could be diminishing returns, and we may be there already. I think we've stuck with it because it worked well for us to have 15 guides in our LDL screen. And I think if we reduce that, the advantage would be that we would be able to test more genes, you know, going from 800 or so genes that we tested in this study to, you know, maybe 1200 or 1500 if we reduce that number. But we wanted to be, I think if we were going to err on one side, we wanted to have a really kind of robust signal for a smaller set of genes than to have more genes tested with perhaps more equivocal, signal.
Yeah. So something to clarify, I was talking about whole genome libraries when I first was explaining a CRISPR screen, which is where a lot of people start, ourselves included. And as Brian's talking about, and as we're talking about related to this paper, it's not clear. We rely a lot for our most successful studies. We've seen a huge benefit of using secondary libraries. So we actually build our own sort of custom libraries because we've realized after doing lots of whole genome screens, kind of getting at this question you had with the whole, is there an upper limit? We see a huge difference in signal to noise when we make these custom libraries and target a smaller number of genes at a greater depth of coverage. So including more guides per gene, which is what Brian was getting at there. So yeah, we sort of curated this library based on other publications and just gave us a lot greater statistical power, which we realized at the end, you know, it stinks that you don't realize this always until you get your data back, but it really helps and it's really important having enough statistical power to have confidence in those hits that you're selecting. So a lot of times our whole genome screens are good enough to build a secondary library from, and that's what's helped us so far, but not quite statistically strong enough to like make any grand conclusions from. So
great preliminary data though, right? If you're writing a grant, that must be great. So you've done your big CRISPR screen and you get some hits out. So some of the things you found were histone acetyl transferases. I think SMAD came out in that. So could you talk a little about your top hits and where you think, why they're important, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we looked at what came out of it, if we look at kind of functional annotations among those hits, we clearly see that transcription factors, histone modifying enzyme, epigenetic regulators are very much enriched among the genes that showed a signal in our screen. We also looked at kind of known protein-protein interactions and saw very strong enrichment for that. And among those, so with the greatest functional effect, we saw SMAD4 towards that the top of that list, and then some other genes that are known to interact with SMAD4. And that's what we chose as a pathway to kind of follow up on for some more kind of mechanistic studies and for testing of the relevance to SARS-CoV-2 infection in the BSL-3 work that we did with Carmen and Christiane Wobis. So, you know, SMAD4 is this transcription factor. It integrates signaling from a variety of kind of upstream receptors and the signaling cascades that signal through SMAD4 to bind to target genes and modify their expression. We don't know yet kind of what's upstream of SMAD4, what receptors are you know, being activated that are signaling through SMAD4, and where SMAD4 is binding to regulate ACE2. Those are questions that we're very much interested in pursuing, but that's kind of the framework that we have from this screen.
And a lot of the sort of regulators of epigenetics tend to be, from my understanding, it's not so much the amount of these enzymes you have or proteins you have, it's more their activity levels. And so is this something, I imagine this is probably a follow-up work, but is this something you're thinking about looking at?
Yeah, I think so. I think that would be interesting to look at. I think we're also very interested in the cell type specificity of this effect. I think, as Emily mentioned, there have been other groups that have done some really fantastic CRISPR screens for SARS-CoV-2 cytopathic effect in different cell lines. And one finding that's really striking to me is that the functional modifiers of cytopathic effect don't overlap very much between those studies. In general, what was found for, say, VRO-E6 cells and HUH7.5 cells and some other cell lines that have been tested have been very different, which I think points to cell type specificity. And I think also when we look at our ACE2 modifiers that we found from our screen, and we looked whether or not they had a signal in those cytopathic effect screens, we see a lot of overlap with the screen that was done in HUH7.5 cells, but not very much overlap with the screens that were done in other cell lines. So I think that points to the idea that there's a lot of cell type specific regulation of ACE2 expression. And so we'd like to explore that further and see how much overlap there is.
That sounds complex. Sounds fun, yeah. But it sounds like that would be, complex. So Emma, do you want to ask the next one? Seeing as your lab's background stuff for this one.
I was just, so you mentioned, Emily, in your comments that you're excited about general advancements in next-gen sequencing and like the technology and capabilities. I'm just wondering if you'd give a bit more information about that, because I'm about to, as you were just talking about on your screen, I'm literally about to do my next-gen sequencing.
I did a talk a few months back that was for undergraduates, but kind of more about the technology of CRISPR screening, and also with that, just next-gen sequencing and how much it's really advanced research. So, I mean, I just think looking back, it's kind of crazy to think that, you know, I forget what year the first sequence of the human genome came out, but it's really not that long ago, like 20 years ago, something like that. Not even, is 2003 maybe? Yeah, early 2000s. And so, I mean, now we submit, I mean, we wouldn't be able to do these sort of CRISPR screens without the power of next gen sequencing. And, you know, getting these millions of sequencing reads that we need to detect our signal. But I mean, not just for our screen, but also just generally speaking, you know, the genome of SARS-CoV-2 was sequenced in like a matter of days, I think, once someone decided that was a worthwhile endeavor. It's just cool to me that, you know, without that technology, which is advancing really rapidly now, But, you know, without that, this pandemic really could have been a whole different story, and it could be very scary for us if science wasn't where it's at. And, you know, that goes into development of these vaccines and all of that. So really, it's just cool, I think, to sort of look at that timeline and realize that not very long ago, we would not be even close to in a position to be able to do these kind of studies.
2003 was the first sequence of the human genome. Thank you, John. So you mentioned the CoV-2 sequence coming out really quickly. That, I think, was released within 2 weeks, and it was done on Virology. So it wasn't just released, it was released very publicly and for free.
Yep.
But essentially a preprint, just a plug preprint a bit more.
Yeah.
The sequencing baffles me, and it's amazing. So there was a paper I read recently where, because one of the things they try to do pushing sequencing going forward is to start to sequence proteins and look at the proteome a bit more, because that's, in terms of tools, it's a bit lacking. It has been for quite a while now. So, where do you think sequencing is going in the future? What would you like to see?
You know, it's amazing how much innovation there is that, you know, finds these clever uses of next-gen sequencing. We've started to pick up some other techniques like ATAC-seq and RNA-seq as well. And, you know, looking at what some people are doing with like 3D confirmation of genomes and Hi-C and things like that. I think it's almost hard to predict, you know, what the next application will be. I think there's a tendency for most people, especially people that aren't doing bench work, to kind of see the progress in sequencing technologies and to think that it's just used for sequencing human genomes, you know, and that we can do that more quickly now, and we can look at genetic variation within a population or find causative mutations associated with a disease state. But I'm really struck by all of the clever, you know, innovations that have been made that rely on next-gen sequencing as this extraordinarily powerful kind of tool and, you know, readout.
Yeah, I mean, you'll probably be familiar with Jay Shenjue's lab then. He's like, everything he does is just mind-blowing. It's amazing, the stuff they come up with.
Yeah.
So moving on from the science questions a little bit, why did you decide to preprint this work? And this wasn't the, you know, you've done a few preprints now, so obviously you quite like preprints, but what was the motivation behind that?
Yeah, I think, you know, in general, at a fundamental level, I believe in openness in science, and I think, you know, even at the publication stage, we favor open access journals. We've published in PLOS journals and eLife and, you know, really support that. I think that's the primary motivation, is just to kind of share the work with the world. I think all the more so during a pandemic. You know, I wouldn't claim that we have any kind of direct, you know, clinical impact from this work, that we're going to change anything about how COVID's being treated. But I think that we hope to make progress to the, you know, kind of advancement of science around SARS-CoV-2 biology and virus host interactions. And, you know, we hope that this work might help someone else. And, you know, I think at a minimum, identifying antibodies that truly are specific, you know, if someone else out there is studying ACE2 at the protein level, we would hope that they would benefit from our work to kind of validate different antibodies. And if they're looking for ways to perturb ACE2 levels in cell lines, you know, I think sharing what we've found could help someone else's work. I think that's, you know, at its core, you know, the motivation for why we'd like to put this up as a preprint.
The kind of things we like to promote over here.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think also you've touched on this in previous episodes, but I think the temptation for some researchers is to think that if they post it and they share it, they might get scooped and there might be negative, you know, effects from it. And maybe we'll find that to be true at some point. I don't think so. But I think there are practical benefits to us too. I think, you know, as I put in grant applications, it's nice to be able to show kind of a product of the work that we've done. And so I think that those benefits outweigh the risks of being scooped personally. But I think, you know, ultimately it's about the desire to kind of be open and share the science that we've done.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always pushing the fact that I think preprints, certainly for early career researchers, are just hugely beneficial, mainly for a lot of those reasons you've just mentioned. So Emily, you've moved out of academia, you've shifted out of academia, but were preprints helpful in that transition too? Because that's not something I've not spoken to many people who've done that about this.
Yeah, I mean, my current position kind of came, like, I wasn't really searching for it exactly. It kind of landed in my lap, which was, you know, I'm not complaining about that. But I know for, you know, I can speak to, I guess, two different stages, because I finished my PhD actually during the pandemic. And sort of while we were working on this, actually, I wrote my thesis. So in that phase, I was kind of deciding, should I try to go on the job market? Should I not? That was a little bit intimidating during the pandemic as well, because, I mean, even just knowing from U of M, we were on a hiring freeze. So unless you had funds from like a private foundation or something like that, any funds that were through the university were essentially frozen. So, and I know that's the case a lot of other universities as well, could only assume, and just through searching as well, like not as many people were hiring, and unless you were doing some sort of COVID research, you know, you weren't gonna, it's not the best time to look for a job. But Brian and I also had this project going, and I was having a lot of fun, you know, working on it with him. And so I decided to do a postdoc and keep working with Brian for almost a year. In applying to positions, it is helpful. I know that preprints on BioArchive and things are viewed as publications, generally speaking, on CVs, especially for PhDs and postdocs, because, you know, part of the problem there is, as a grad student or even a postdoc, if you're looking to make that next step and you want to move on to the next thing, you know, the publication process can take a really long time. So preprints, I think, help enormously in that, because, you know, I understand from both sides, as an employer, you want to be able to look at this person and see some work that they've done and know that they're capable. But also just the peer review process is, I mean, we finished this project probably almost a year ago, and it's not yet published in a journal. So, I mean, we've been working on it. It's not like we haven't been working on it for the last year, but I don't remember when our first submission was, but it's been quite some time, because I was still working at U of M when we submitted it. So that can be really problematic for, you know, a grad student who's on like a 5 or 6 year timeline or something. If you're wanting to finish up, to have to wait on that, it means that you need to really have finished a project by like year three.
Year three. That's in the UK. That's when we finish our PhD.
Oh my gosh.
It's incredibly tight to try and get a paper published, at least.
Yeah. Oh gosh, I can imagine.
So how do you find working in industry as opposed to academia?
Yeah. I mean, so far it's, I won't lie, and I hope Brian takes no offense to this, because it has nothing to do with him, but it's been a nice change of pace. Just, you know, being in more of the 9-to-5 lifestyle has been really nice. And I'm still working with science. I'm still very involved in science. It's just kind of from a different angle. So I actually still work with U of M. U of M is part of my territory, and I'm a big part of the researchers that I work with. So now, instead of doing the bench work myself, I am kind of consulting with a lot of different labs and hearing about their work, and seeing if I can steer them in the right direction of different things that will work for them. So yeah, I mean, so far it's, I can't lie, it's been nice. And I do, you know, I loved my time at U of M, and there's a lot of things that I love about academia, but just sort of, there has been some just general pressure that's been lifted from my shoulders. That's been a bit of a relief after a stressful pandemic year.
Anyway, yeah, I don't think I know anyone who actually, from my friendship group, who is wanting to stay in academia, to be honest. They're all trying to move. I think I'm the only one crazy enough to be wanting to stay. But I also moved. I quit my old postdoc in the middle of the pandemic and moved to a new one. And it's stressful moving during a pandemic and starting a new job. How was starting in industry actually? So, I mean, starting in academia, we were in a position where we weren't allowed in the lab together. So all my training for the lab work was done over Zoom. So my boss would be in the lab doing the work, and I just have to watch him do it to try and learn how to do it. So how was industry side of that instead? That presumably was a bit better.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, my position is somewhat remote as it is. So I manage a territory, Michigan, Minnesota, and a couple of other states in the Midwest. So my team is sort of all over the central U.S. And our headquarters is in the Bay Area in California. So my training was all done virtually anyways. Normally they would have brought us on site, Mountain View, but of course that's still not a thing. So everything was done over Zoom, but I mean, it was fine. And I've had a couple of opportunities actually to travel. My supervisor is in Ohio, so it's not too far from where I'm at. So I've been able to actually meet up with her for a little bit of in-person training, which has been good. It is exhausting being on Zoom for a training like all day for a week, but it's been okay.
And you've circumnavigated the globe. That was your fun fact that I forgot to mention at the start.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not at all jealous. That sounds so amazing.
It was amazing. Definitely one of my favorite things to talk about. I do love traveling and something I've missed in the last couple of years.
No way. It'll come back eventually.
Yeah. So I did do a semester at sea when I was in college. I spent a semester living on a cruise ship. And so we started on the west coast of the U.S. and ended up in Southampton in the U.K. and flew back to the States after that. So I got to see lots of countries, experience lots of cultures, and people in science ask me like, "Oh, were you doing research or some like oceanography stuff?" I did zero science on the trip, but it was fun. Good thing, good way to have some fun and like enjoy life a little bit before grad school. So.
Good to get on the cruise ship before the pandemic too.
Yeah.
So while we're on the topic of COVID, Brian, you, as you mentioned, you're a physician, and you were on that front line of when COVID started to hit. How was that? That sounds nothing but terrifying.
Yeah, it was. So I, like I said, I only spent 20% of my total effort on the wards as an inpatient general medicine attending. It just so happened that I was on service in late March last year when COVID was just starting to kind of pop up in Michigan. And so going into that, you know, there was of course a lot of anxiety. We were reading kind of firsthand accounts from various places, including Lombardy in Italy, which had just been hit right before us. And some of the accounts from frontline workers were really scary. And so there was this sense that it was coming. And so I'll never forget, I was on for 7 days. And the first day that I was on service, we had 10 patients admitted to our hospital with COVID-19. And by the time I rotated off service a week later, we were up to 100. And so, you know, that was stressful. It was manageable. It was within our kind of surge capacity. But the really scary part was not knowing if how it went from 10 to 100 in a week, if a week later it would then be 1,000 or 10,000 the week after that. And so not knowing where that peak would be, I think, was the most stressful part of it. And my clinical division of hospital medicine, led by Vineet Chopra, was really kind of at the forefront of our hospital's response and our kind of strategic planning around how to prepare for this. And so, you know, we have a lot of athletic facilities here at the University of Michigan, and we were making preparations to convert some of those athletic facilities to military style field hospitals and kind of rethinking how would we deliver care if we had this kind of overwhelming surge of patients. And it ended up peaking around 250 admitted patients. It was an enormous stress on the system, but it didn't reach that kind of, you know, catastrophic point where we would have to be, you know, going to that kind of next line of response. But I'll never forget it. You know, that combination of having all of these patients come in with this new disease that we didn't have experience with, combined with the kind of uncertainty about where things were going.
And then you jumped out of that stress into the stress of starting a lab, which is, I mean, that's stressful enough, but then you did that mid-pandemic too. How was that? I know someone else is doing that, and he thinks it's been quite stressful.
Yeah, it was delayed. I've been very lucky. And my postdoc mentor, David Ginsberg, has been extraordinarily supportive of me. And so, as Emily mentioned, as the pandemic kind of raged on, there were restrictions here around discretionary spending and hiring. And then there were also restrictions on capacity. So we could only have so many people in the lab. Actually, at the very beginning, the labs were shut down unless you were working on COVID-19. And so Emily and I both had exemptions because our project was related to COVID-19 to still come in, but the building was kind of deserted. So my postdoc mentor basically let me squat in his space. Even after I had kind of my own appointment and my commitment for independent space, I wasn't able to move in yet. And so Emily and I both stayed in his space and worked there and were able to keep things going. And then gradually, as things kind of got better and the restrictions loosened up, but just recently I've been able to move into my own space.
So now the true excitement's building up where everything's yours now.
Yeah. And, you know, even, you know, despite having my own space, there's so many challenges around, you know, something as simple as getting cold storage and trying to find a minus 20 or a minus 80 freezer when everybody wants them for vaccines, or trying to find pipette tips. You know, just getting operational has been extraordinarily challenging.
The lab shortages have been driving us all crazy. We've ran out of gloves, tips, just about everything. PBS, yeah. We ran out for quite a while. And it's been a slow year for science outside of COVID-related science, I think. So you're a clinician, you've got academic on the go, you've got a family. How do you balance all that? That's a lot of different things to be juggling all at once.
Yeah, it's hard. I'm not sure I have any great solutions. I'm probably still learning as I go. I think I'm very fortunate by the support system around me. My wife, Laura, is fantastic and, you know, manages so much of the childcare and everything at home. I'm very lucky for that. I certainly couldn't do this without her. And then, you know, the people that I work with, you know, from David Ginsberg to my clinical chief and everybody have been really supportive. And so I'm still trying to figure out how to best achieve that balance, but I couldn't do it on my own.
Yeah, the environment's really, really important where you work. It makes a huge difference, I think. And my understanding of the clinician pathway in America is based entirely on scrubs. So where are you on that ladder?
Yeah, so I'm an attending physician. So I did my medical school training at Northwestern. I did an MD PhD program there. And then I came to the University of Michigan for my internal medicine residency. And I originally had the idea that I would be a subspecialist, that I would go on and do a clinical fellowship. And that had been the plan. And along the way, I had twin boys towards the end of residency. And I had a little bit of training fatigue, having gone through the MD PhD training and residency. And I decided I would work as a hospitalist. I thought initially for a year or two, and some people do that as kind of a bridge to fellowship and subspecialty training. And I just sort of thought that by default, I think, you know, I knew I wanted to be a physician scientist. I wanted to do lab research, and I didn't have any kind of role models in hospital medicine that had done that before. Most hospitalists that do research do more like health services research, not bench research. And so I hadn't really considered it as a possibility. It wasn't until I interviewed for the position that the division chief, Larry McMahon at that time, kind of floated this idea that if I wanted to be a physician scientist, I didn't have to go back and do a fellowship, that they would support me and carve out some protected time for me to do research if I found a research mentor. And that's how I ended up working with David Ginsberg. It wasn't the original plan, but it ended up being that I never went back for fellowship training. I stayed a generalist. And so now I'm attending on the wards in that capacity.
I think that is all of my questions. That was a great chat. I enjoyed that.
Thank you.
I'm definitely going to talk to my supervisor about doing something maybe similar.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've learned a lot along the way. It's along the way from our failures or, you know, struggles. And I think that's one of the things, you know, like Emily mentioned, that we've come to appreciate, is that the improved depth that we get from a more focused screen, at least for flow cytometry, makes a big difference. I think if you're doing like a viability screen and you can culture, you know, many, many plates easily and get hundreds of millions of cells, that's one thing. But I think when we're going on to a flow cytometer and we have that bottleneck that we can only sort so many cells over a given period of time, it makes it tough to do a genome-wide screen. We've done that. You know, I think we've had some success with a couple different screens, including our original PCSK9 secretion screen and then our LDL uptake screen, but it's hard. And so I think we're kind of steering more towards kind of focused approaches with higher resolution, you know, more guides, more cells per guide.
I mean, currently, I think our ones have 5 or 6 guide RNAs per gene. So very simple, like the whole genome one. And then we have a druggable genome as well. But yeah.
Yeah, there's some others in our lab, I think, who were, or at least at one point, were trying to find a sweet spot of how many guides per gene you need. Because we had only done 15 or 6, I think. So it's possible that maybe having like 8 to 12 would also work out and give you some more power, but
yeah, it really comes down to like your intent with the screen. Are you trying to find like leads for further investigation? Are you trying to find kind of more definitive conclusions about the functional relationships that you see?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, the idea is I've got this high throughput CRISPR screen, and I want to apply for a grant to do more investigative stuff and how to validate some of my hits. And potentially doing a more focused screen might help. I mean, I'll talk to my supervisor, but it's very nice to talk to you about it and learn lots. Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. for coming on and giving us your time so early on in our
absolutely little, if anyone listening is interested in what we're doing or would like to talk more, please reach out. But thank you for having us. I think this was a lot of fun, and it's a neat idea for a podcast, and good luck to you guys.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I can attest also for anyone that's looking for a postdoc, Brian is a fantastic mentor. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Brian's hiring.
Well, thank you so much, guys. Nice meeting you all.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows. Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.